before you.
All right, we're ready when you are. Wilson versus the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court? My name is Kevin Bailey. I'm from Lynchburg, and I represent the appellate, Mr. Billy Ray Wilson. This court should reverse and remand his conviction in this case because the Commonwealth's evidence did not exclude the reasonable hypothesis that he was not the driver, that a female was the driver, and that she left the scene of the accident before before the first responders arrived.
Doesn't that require basically that the fact finder necessarily accept his version of what occurred?
Your Honor, we're not asking for the court to reweigh the evidence in this particular case, and I would draw the court's attention to the Commonwealth's brief where they actually quoted Stevens, Court of Appeals case from 2002. And their brief states, when a fact finder arbitrarily ignores the reasonableness of the innocence hypothesis, the decision should be overturned on appeal.
Well, and that presupposes they arbitrarily ignored it. I mean, here the Commonwealth's evidence is a circumstantial case as to who was driving. But the evidence is there's a one-car accident. Your client is found hanging upside down in the seatbelt behind the wheel of the car. When the emergency medical technician arrives, your client says, "Hey, dog, can I tell him you were driving?" And there were some statements made at the hospital. You know, it seems to me that while there's certainly no direct evidence as to who was driving the car, there's certainly plenty of indirect evidence from which a fact finder can draw some reasonable inferences as to your client being the driver, as opposed to some mysterious third party who's never seen again, you know, being there.
Yes, sir. To respond to that, first off, he was not in the seatbelt.
He admits he was driving in the hospital. If you take the statement, "I flipped my Jeep," I mean, that certainly seems to imply that he was the operator of the vehicle at that time. So, I mean, that's actually direct evidence as opposed to circumstantial evidence.
That would have been direct evidence, Your Honor. But
seatbelt or not, he had his legs wrapped, found with his legs wrapped around the steering column, didn't he?
Your Honor, the vehicle did flip at least once, perhaps more, we don't know. But he was pinned by the steering wheel in the dash area. He was not buckled in. But as to his statement he made at the hospital, he petitioned the court to suppress that statement. Trial counsel did that.
Well, no, but that doesn't matter, though. In a sufficiency argument, we take evidence, even improperly admitted evidence, as to whether it's legally sufficient. So,
well,
in that sense, even if it should have been suppressed, it would still be considered by us from a sufficiency standpoint.
When the court should consider what the trooper said on cross examination. He couldn't say exactly what was said. I flipped my Jeep, the Jeep flipped. He couldn't say for sure. So sure, that piece of evidence was something the jury considered, as well as this individual being pinned by the wheel, as well as he being the only individual in the vehicle. They did consider all that. What I'm asking the court to do is find that they arbitrarily ignored the reasonableness of this other hypothesis of innocence, which is there was a...
But couldn't a fact finder simply hear that evidence and say, "I don't believe it, I think he's lying, and therefore it's inherently not a reasonable hypothesis of innocence"?
Your Honor, the defendant didn't testify in the case. His statements were admitted into evidence. And Your Honor, he made the statement to two different individuals. First, he made the statement to Eric Spencer, told Eric Spencer there was a female driver and she left. The other first responder, Brian Harris, was approached by a female. That female said, "There's someone still in the vehicle." That female was never spoken to by this particular officer after that. He told Trooper Bulletin the same thing, that there was a female operating the vehicle and she fled the scene. Then two defense witnesses testified that they saw the defendant leave his residence in the vehicle, on the passenger side, with a female by the name of Marie driving that vehicle. Now, there were some discrepancies in that testimony.
Yeah, the female was either blonde or brunette or redhead or...
Yes, sir. Yeah, okay. The testimony was dark, chunky, with glasses. That was Brandon Carter's testimony. Okay. And then the testimony of Miss Dolly Bryant was she may have been a lot brown hair, maybe not as small as I am. That it was different. I grant the court that. But, Your Honor, I would argue that the discrepancies, I think, support the idea that it wasn't some collaborated or contrived testimony that they put together and they were trying to match it up, because we've got to go in and we've got to help our friend out, we've got to help our dad out. So you have all these, this evidence that there was a second occupant, that she was the driver.
And my argument is that you take the location of the defendant, his condition, his ability to not extract himself, move, or anything like that, and come up with a theory that somebody else could have been driving, got out of that overturned car, and somehow the defendant got wrapped around the steering wheel and in that. How do you come up with something that an interpretation of the physical facts that could possibly put somebody else in the driver's seat, and you could have had that person vanish and the defendant get tangled up the way he was in the condition and incapacitated the way he was? I mean, how can you come up with something that's reasonable?
I think what the court's saying is that our version of what may have happened is unreasonable and the jury adopted the right version of events. I think that's what the court's saying. What I would submit to the court was,
why is that not a reasonable conclusion for the trier of fact to make?
It is believable, Your Honor.
Well, if it's believable, then doesn't that end the case here?
No, Your Honor, I would say not, because there is another reasonable and believable explanation.
No, if there's reasonable, their conclusion is reasonable, it makes your theory that there was another driver unreasonable, because the two can't exist. You can't have one person, two people in the same physical place at the same time.
Yes, sir. I would say that in any given case, perhaps there is more than one reasonable interpretation of the evidence. And this is a circumstantial
case. But in this case, it's physically impossible for two people to occupy the same physical space, and that's the driver's seat.
Your Honor, I didn't brief this case. I'm the third man on this case. Mr. Childress, who is now a prosecutor and doing well in Amherst County, he argued that, and I would make the same argument, that the windows were broken out of the vehicle, that the doors weren't able to be opened, that the victim, excuse me, that the female driver could have been ejected through the window, could have crawled out the window, and that somehow as this vehicle is turning at least once, maybe twice, maybe three times, that they are discombobulated there in the cabin of the vehicle, and that he somehow gets pinned by the steering wheel and that she leaves. I would submit that that is a reasonable explanation. The answer, the final result, the conclusion of the jury is also a reasonable one. But that's my argument. That's my point here today. There are two reasonable explanations. They adopted one, and I argue that they arbitrarily and unreasonably just disregarded the evidence and the facts. But, you know, I point in my brief to three cases that deal with the operation of a motor vehicle, and I'd like to distinguish those for you briefly today.
Sure.
The first one I'd like to mention is the Kesey case. It's the Court of Appeals case from 2000. In that particular case, the vehicle did not turn over. The vehicle was on its side. The defendant's legs were pinned under the steering wheel and dashboard. He was alone in the vehicle. He was unable to move. He told the police officer in that case that he was heading home. There were keys in the ignition. Taillight was illuminated. There was no other reasonable explanation other than he had been driving the vehicle. In the Lyons v. City of Petersburg, 1980 Supreme Court case, in that particular case, the defendant ran into a parked car. He was behind the steering wheel. There was another party in the vehicle. And the officer in that particular case concluded that he ran into a parked car, and there was no other witness or testimony to the contrary. And the court concluded there's no other reasonable explanation. In the Carter case, 2001 Court of Appeals, the car was not flipped. It ran into a garage. Defendant was again trapped behind the wheel. The court said that the fact that he was trapped behind the wheel negates his explanation that he was just sliding over. There was a head-on collision, and in a head-on collision, I don't think you can make a reasonable argument that when you hit an immovable object, you somehow move from side to side. It was a head-on collision into a garage. So the idea that he was sliding over during the middle of the crash and was pinned was an unbelievable, unreasonable argument. And that's not what we have here. We have a vehicle that flipped, and Martin Lee, it's reasonable to believe that there was a second person, and she crawled out and disappeared before law enforcement got there. And I'll save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Ms. Martin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. In this case, we ask that the convictions be affirmed because the trial court did not err in its ruling regarding the admission of a voluntary statement to the trooper, and also the evidence supported the fact that the defendant was the driver of this vehicle. The difference between this case and some of the other cases that the defendant was trying to distinguish is that at the time of the crash, Brian Carter was interviewed by the state trooper, and he did not, at that point, make any comment about there being any other driver in the car. He said that he had not seen the defendant drive because he wasn't home when the defendant left Carter's house. And then he also knew that the defendant wasn't supposed to drive. So when they get to trial, Brian Carter then testifies that he and the defendant had been in Lynchburg from like 7:30 to 9:45. They'd come back to Carter's house where they had invited some friends. They were drinking beer. The defendant had invited this woman named Marie that Carter didn't know. And she was short, chunky, had black hair and glasses. She wanted to drive the SUV, so they left to go get some more beer, and that's when this accident happened. And he didn't see Marie again. She'd come in a van to his house, and that van was gone the next morning. And then there was this other woman who testified, Dolly Bryant. She said that she went to Carver's house about 7 or 8 p.m. She was the last person to get there. The defendant introduced her to Maria. She had light brown hair. She was sort of medium sized. She didn't have glasses. She had an accent. She was not from the local area. And that she, Maria, was driving the SUV when the defendant left, about 10 or so, and this Bryant was following them because she went the other direction to her house. But she had never told the police before trial anything about this. And so the fact finder was entitled to reject the testimony of those witnesses. And in doing so, they could then infer that these witnesses had lied to support the defendant, and the defendant had also lied when he had said to the trooper and the EMT people at the crash site that he had not been driving. And the only evidence that there was some other woman who was the driver and then left the scene came from the defendant. And if the defendant's version is not believed, then the light was favorable to the Commonwealth. Viewing the evidence, the circumstantial evidence supports the fact that the defendant was the driver, plus we have his statement at the hospital that he voluntarily blurted out while the implied consent was being read to him that he flipped his Jeep. And then the trooper said, well, I thought you said you weren't driving, and then he sort of clarified, well, I know I was in the Jeep when it flipped. But we have the fact that at the scene, he asked at least two of the MTP people, can I say that you were driving? There was no evidence that there had been anyone else in the car. No other personal belongings were found there. The fact that this unidentified woman comes up after the crash and says, well, there's someone in the vehicle, doesn't mean that she was the driver. There were several bystanders, I believe 5 to 10 is what the testimony was. This was a residential rural area. People probably heard the crash. They came out to see what was going on. So there's just nothing to connect this person, this woman, with being the driver. And so if we look at all those things, also the defendant was a convicted felon. He gave the EMT people incorrect name to begin with. He was tangled up in the steering column, was unable to get out, and has been pointed out, the defendant was 5'10 and weighed 225 pounds. And we have this woman who is short and chunky or medium sized or whatever. So if she's the driver, it just doesn't make any sense that somehow when the defendant in the passenger seat gets flipped over when the SUV turns over and he somehow ends up in the driver's seat with his feet tangled around the steering column, that this little tiny woman is going to be able to climb out of this broken window. I mean, how did she get out from underneath him? Because he had to fall on top of her. Now, maybe she got thrown out, but then you might think, well, you know, wouldn't maybe your billfold, some lipstick or something, wouldn't that have been found in the SUV or found in the ground around the SUV? And there was just no evidence to support the defendant's theory that there was some other person, this woman, who had been driving.
Well, if the windows were broken and she was ejected out the window, presumably she would have been cut or severely, at least
right.
to some
there,
extent,
there
injured.
Would have been, there would have been something to show that she'd gotten thrown out. Maybe her clothes got attached to a piece of glass, or she certainly probably might have been injured. And the EMTs also said that they came from different directions to this crash site. They hadn't seen anyone walking along the road. You know, they didn't see anybody but just these people who were the bystanders. So there's just nothing to support the defendant's theory of this case. And viewing the light and the evidence in the light was favorable to the Commonwealth, the fact that the jury was entitled to reject the defendant's witness's testimony, certainly all of those things do support the finding that the evidence was sufficient to prove the defendant was the driver of this vehicle. With regard to the second issue, I will rely on my brief unless the court has any particular questions about that.
Hearing none, we thank you very much, Ms. Martin.
Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, your remaining time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Your Honors, the court did reject the defense argument. The jury chose not to believe it. And my position today is that they arbitrarily ignored a second reasonable explanation of the facts. And I'd like to talk about a few things Judge Humphreys mentioned earlier. As far as his statement, I draw the court's attention to page 158 in the record. On cross-examination, defense counsel was able to elicit a response from the trooper Bulletin, that he clearly didn't remember exactly what was said. So did he say...
Well, I think in the original question on direct, the trooper's response was prefaced by, defendant said words to the effect of, and then the quote that I think I read earlier.
Yes, sir. And he wasn't sure, it wasn't clear exactly what was said, and there were some issues with what was in the report and whether he remembered what was in the report and whether what was in his report was exactly what was said, and could he remember what was said. So there were some issues there. I draw the court's attention to that. I'd also draw the court's attention to page 347 of the record and look at the pictures of the accident. You can tell that it at least flipped once, very possible flipped more than once. And so you have an accident where it's believable that two individuals that were not strapped in were moved around in that cabin and perhaps shuffled their positions inside the cabin. Ms. Martin notes that there was no female stuff there. They were going on a beer run, and she probably didn't have a suitcase with her. Who knows if she had a purse, or maybe she grabbed a purse and took it out. But the fact that there was nothing there does not mean she was not there. There was a post, there were several points made that this lady was there. The jury just completely rejected it. And I asked the court to find that that though the evidence is viewed in a lot most favor of the Commonwealth, that the evidence is still viewed through the penetrating lens of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They arbitrarily ignored the second reasonable hypothesis, and for the aforementioned reasons, for the distinguishing, for how we distinguished the cases before, we ask the court to reverse and remand the matter.
Very well, thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and thereafter take up Withrow versus the Commonwealth.